For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening. Good evening. I'm Douglas Floyd. I am the president of the board of directors at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and I'm talking to you tonight because our lead Dharma teacher, Taigen Dan Leighton, is on sabbatical. He'll be back in October, the beginning of October. And while he's been away for the past 5 months, a number of members of the Sangha have been taking turns giving Dharma talks, which has been interesting, and I hope Taigen hasn't been displeased with them so far. On Monday nights, I like to talk about, when I'm talking, I like to talk about koans, and I've circulated copies of one. It's on Sundays, when we have more first-timers come, I like to talk about Zazen to sort of expand their introduction in the workshop that we hold every Sunday morning. So what we have tonight is case 36 from the Book of Serenity. Master Ma is unwell. And this story is also included in case 3 at the Blue Cliff Record. So it's a pretty important story. So let's read the case and the verse that Tiantong Hongzhi recorded. The case goes, Master Ma was unwell. The monastery superintendent asked, Master, how is your venerable state these days? The great teacher said, Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. And the verse reads, Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, stars fall, thunder rolls, the mirror faces forms without subjectivity. The pearl in a bowl rolls of itself. Don't you see before the hammer gold refined 100 times? Under the scissors, silk from one bolt. So, let me give you some background. Master Ma was Ma Zu Dao Yi, and we've run into him before, just to place him in some context that would be familiar to him. His teacher was Nanyue Huairong, who, you'll remember the story, it was Mazu who was sitting doing Zazen, and Master Nanyue said, what are you doing Zazen? And he said, I'm doing Zazen to become a Buddha, and Nanyue picked up a roof tile and started polishing it, and Mazu said, well, what are you doing? And he said, I'm making a mirror. And Mazu said, well, how do you make a mirror out of by polishing a roof tile? And Nanyue said, how do you make a Buddha out of sitting in Zazen? So that's a case we've talked about before. And I hope I'm not off base. Mazu had 80 Dharma heirs, students who he had authorized to teach, which is just seems impossible to believe, but that's what the literature says. And if I'm not mistaken, the two of the most important ones were Nanchuan, who you're familiar with. You may be familiar with the story about Nanchuan kills a cat, where monks are fighting in the meditation hall, and Nanchuan picks up the cat and says, I'm going to cut this cat in half unless you can say a word of Zen. And they don't speak, so he cuts the cat in half. The other main student was Baizhang. And you'd be familiar with the story about Baizhang and the fox, where a mysterious stranger comes to listen to a Dharma talk and then comes up to talk to Baizhang and discloses that, in fact, he is a fox. That thousands of years ago, he used to be the teacher at this monastery, but he answered a question wrong in response to a monk, and he was reborn as a fox for 500 lifetimes. So Baijan gives him a different answer, response to the question, and the monk thanks him, goes off, and dies, and Baijan then holds a funeral for the fox when they go out into the hills and find it. So Mazu was interesting. He was the Zen master who sort of created the style that people think about when they think about Zen teaching. He was the one who was the first one, in response to questions, he would hit a student with his stick or slap them or twist their nose, or he would just lift up his fly whisk, or he would say something completely incomprehensible, or a monk would ask a question and he'd answer and the monk wouldn't understand, and when the monk was leaving he would shout and then call their name. And all of these were sort of methods, shock methods, to sort of bring the monk right here, to cut through the habitual thinking they were caught up in and bring him right here. And he was physically imposing. Sometimes he was called the horse master, and they would talk about he was so huge that he walked powerfully like a bull when they saw him. And he had circles on the bottoms of his feet, which is a little strange. And most notably, my favorite feature about him is that his tongue was so long that he could stick it out and touch his forehead. So, that's Master Ma. So let's talk about the case. You know, it begins with Master Ma was unwell. It's not just that Master Ma was unwell. The literature says that he died the next day. So he's on his deathbed when the temple director comes in and says, "Master, how is your venerable state these days?" Well, he knows exactly how he is, but he's being polite, right? And Master Ma says, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." And when you look at this, and if you've got some background in Zen, there are some people who comment on it. I think if you read through it quickly, you think, okay, the sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha came from the Sutra of Buddha Names, which has the names of, I don't know, like 1,200 Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in it. And the sun-faced Buddha lives for 1,800 years. And the moon-faced Buddha lives for a day and a night, so 24 hours. And in this context, I think you can see it, right, as the sun-faced Buddha, the Buddha with the powerful light, and the long day is talking about health, and the moon-faced Buddha with the weaker light and the short life refers to Master Ma himself, who's sick and dying and has a very short life ahead of him. And I think it's sort of tempting when you go sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, to think, this is talking about Buddha nature and whether or not you're healthy or sick. It's all Buddha nature. It's all Buddha. It's all the absolute. There is no arising and there's no abiding and no disappearance, no decay, no life or death. It's all good. Don't worry if you're sick and you're going to die. It's all okay. And I really don't think that's what it's talking about. For one thing, it's sun-faced Buddha and moon-faced Buddha. Really? It's saying there are two separate figures. There's no suggestion that Master Ma is talking about dissolving these figures into some great formless Buddha nature that encompasses the entire world. So it's becoming a Buddha. And I think that really what he's saying is, look, when you're healthy and you have a long life ahead of you, be sun-faced Buddha. When you're sick and dying, you're going to die very soon, you're on your deathbed, be moon-faced Buddha. Be a Buddha. Not just be Buddha, be a Buddha. I mean, in one sense, it's absolutely the case that we can say that all of us are Buddha. Buddha nature is the entire world, and Buddha nature, or Buddha, is a term used to talk about the whole. There are different terms used for when you're talking about the entire world, this gigantic, the universe that encompasses everything. You talk about Buddha nature usually, or Buddha, when you're talking about the world is the stage in which Buddhas arise, in which enlightenment occurs. And Buddha nature is a translation of the term Tathagata Garbha, which is the womb of Buddha womb. So this is the world, the universe, as the womb within which Buddhas are born. But what is a Buddha? What does it mean to become sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha? What does it become a Buddha? Well, a Buddha is someone who has stepped out of or let go of the egocentric, self-preoccupied, clinging to your individual self and clinging to the self-preoccupied fears and desires, ideas and emotions that characterize, that are triggered by karma and that act reflexively to shape all of our thoughts, emotions, our speech and our activities so much of the time. And a Buddha is someone who has seen through that and has stepped out of it. And by stepping out of that self-absorption, that egocentricity, has seen the world arise. The Buddha arises in front of the Buddha. But what does that mean? Does it mean that the world looks different? Buddha nature, Buddha isn't something you see. It's something that you embody, that you express in your life. As you step out of this pattern of thinking and feeling in which the world is revolving around you, and you see the world as me, and everything then me on the one hand, and the world is everything out there that is perceived and responded to in terms of how it's going to help me, how it's going to hurt me. And so it's something we do. It's something we do in Zazen. What does it involve? We learn to do this. The difference between us and a Buddha is that a Buddha does it over and over all the time. We have little flashes of awakening where we step out of this egocentricity, this self-absorption, which we're caught up in this whole constant whirling stream of anxiety and need and self-preoccupation. But we practice being Buddha. You know, I mean, there's an old saying that 1 inch of sitting is 1 inch of Buddha. You know, the inch is the inch on the burning incense. It used to time a meditation period. And it's what we do when we're sitting in Zazen. We're just sitting and breathing, sitting upright and breathing, letting our thoughts go. We're aware of our breath, but we're not regulating our breath. We're aware of our thoughts, but we're not regulating our thoughts. There's no attempt to control our thoughts, no attempt to suppress our thoughts, but we're not caught up in them. Then we get caught, we disappear, but we come back. In that moment of awakening, at that moment, Buddha arises in front of us and we find ourselves present in the world. As part of the world, we are Buddha. At that moment, we are Buddhas. And finding ourselves in that, in the world, is to a degree, I think, what Hongzhi's verse is talking about. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, stars fall, thunder rolls. Those are phenomena that occur in the sky, sort of the momentary boom or the shooting star, it appears and flashes in this great spaciousness, which is our experience of finding ourselves in the world, in the spacious world. We're not in this constrained little world of caught up in our own heads. We've opened up to join the world, to meet the world face to face. Without neurotic preoccupation, with our own security. So the mirror faces forms without subjectivity. There are lots of translations of that, but it's talking about the Buddha mind that sees forms without creating a separation among them, which is our experience when we're sitting and we come back. There we are. Here I am. I'm right it's right here. Here I am in this. The pearl in a bowl rolls of itself. It's, you know, we've had the various images and the song of the jewel mirror samadhi, right, of the silver bowl and snow reflecting in it, the pearl rolling around in the silver bowl. And then don't you see before the hammer, gold refined 100 times, under the scissors, silk from one bolt. That's what the silk from one loom is talking about. So it's talking about the unshaped, formless, refined gold that hasn't yet been molded or shaped with tools and the hammer into some specific form, and the bolt of silk that hasn't been cut into forms, emphasizing the potentiality of this spacious reality to take form. The form which is still gold, the form which is still the silk, in the same way that we are part of the world, we have a form, but we are not separate beings. So, you know, I think the point of this, of each moment, we must, as Master Ma says, be sun-faced Buddha, be moon-faced Buddha, be aching knees Buddha, be black robe Buddha, whatever. Be t-shirt Buddha. But we have to wake up to it over and over and over again. And this is something that Master Ma demonstrates in the case himself. When he's asked, how are you feeling there as you're dying in agony? He doesn't say, oh, I feel awful, I'm really afraid, oh my God, don't you feel sorry for me? His response is to step out of those things, the fear and the suffering that he must feel, and reach out to teach the monastery director, look, even now, in the middle of this suffering, we have to wake up. We have to be sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. That's the fundamental message for us, that this is something we need to do, but it's also something that we can do, and it's something that you have done, sitting here on your cushions. None of us spends the entire meditation period daydreaming, caught up in thoughts about what's going to happen, worries about what's going to be happening, frustration about something somebody said to us. We wake up. And in that moment, we find ourselves in the world, we find ourselves in Buddha, and we are awake. Our challenge is not only to do that, not just on the cushion, but to do that in our ordinary lives, waking up over and over and over again, not getting caught up in desires or fears or anger, stepping out of that and acting out of that awakened mind, facing the world without being caught up in fear and anger, so that we can compassionately help others and embody the bodhisattva life. So, I encourage you to please sit on your cushions regularly, as often as you can, waking up over and over and over again, so that you yourselves will be sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, t-shirt Buddha, black robe Buddha, aching knees Buddha, whatever kind of Buddha you are, be that Buddha. Thank you. So we have lots of time. If anyone has anything they want to say about the case, anything they've noticed, any questions you have, any thoughts about practice generally. Jan, you must have something.
I said the same thing last time when we talked about the Buddha. There was a poem I had last time, and it was presented to us as that lakeside sun, and it begins by saying something like, everyone us, and without that, it's like water with us. Without water, no ice. Without us, no river. And that was the first verse of the poem, and that really struck me. And said more about it. Really spoke to me about what it means to be a Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
This was Hoffman's Song of Zazen, right? Is that Hoffman?
Yeah.
Hoffman's right, yeah.
So, you know, it's a popular, more popular inside, but you probably know that, right, Douglas?
Yeah. This very land is the lotus land. This very mind is the Buddha. No? Wait.
Not one, not two. Seems to be kind of what a lot of this is expressing, the idea of not one, not two.
Yeah. That idea that there are forms, but not separate things. Shapes, if you want. We're shapes. We are not independent, fixed things. That we exist only because of the interaction of causes and conditions within us and around us, but also we exist only in relationship. Our existence as things only makes sense in terms of a relationship. And if that's the case, if you ever read Nagarjuna and the Madhyamika Karika, the whole idea that if I only exist, but if I can only be understood as not Wade, then the existence of Wade is part of who I am. So it's not, you know, that whole idea is not just a causal relationship, but it's a contextual relationship. The idea that you can see something that's here right now as an independent, stable thing or self, it's a complete abstraction. It may have some utility for different kinds of things, but as an understanding of what the world is, it doesn't work in coming up with, oh, well, I am this, and therefore this is supposed to happen to me, and this is not what's supposed to happen to me, and I will be very upset if this doesn't happen or this does happen. That's part of the whole chain that we get caught up in. That is avidya. One aspect of avidya, having this misconception about who I am, or not conception, because it's not a philosophical idea, but a sense of who I am. And our grasping emotions and desires and thoughts are completely tied up with that misperception, that confusion. Delusion is always such an interesting word. I don't really quite know what it, I'd rather think of it as confusion. Yeah, we exist, but that's not the whole story. I mean, there's a Douglas here, but that's not the whole story. You can't understand Douglas without taking this more expansive view on the one hand, and a more analytical view that Douglas is all these parts that are constantly changing and therefore can't be considered a self or a thing either. It gets you going and coming. Yes?
Thanks for a great talk. I think that I've taken residence in my home right now because I am still in the ongoing saga of my 15-year-old cat with a brain tumor, who we thought was going to be deceased, you know, probably sometime in April. And he keeps kind of hanging in there in weird ways, but it's very much, and there are lots of other iterations of like, oh no, this can't go on any longer. Because when it gets worse, it just gets worse. But it's very unpredictable, you know, and one minute he's having a seizure, and then, you know, another minute he's like, and I want to stress that we don't think he's suffering, or we would be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, another minute he's you know, running under the couch hoping that he'll avoid having a seizure. Another minute he's spending like 2 days living under the couch. And another minute he's back out, you know, wanting to sit on my lap. And then, you know, another minute he's yelling about how bored he is. And, you know, and then another minute he wants treats. And then another minute he can't find the litter box. And then another minute because he can't see anymore. And so it's just, it's, and it's not, it's kind of a linear progression, but it's also not. And so it's just, but every minute it's still him. And sometimes he really doesn't seem like himself at all. And I think, okay, this is it. This is, you know, this is the beginning of the next end. And then, you know, and then he bounces back. And so it's a lot of impermanence, and you can't really count on one moment to the next. You know, kind of what's going to be happening.
Yeah.
Many of us have, you know, family and loved ones who are maybe in a similar situation. But what I think what I keep remembering is that, you know, at some point that will all end, but then, you know, he will end. So it's just life right there, you know, that it's impermanent and brief and sweet.
Yeah. For me, over the last years, having known more people and pets who have died, I've come to appreciate more and more the idea that we aren't just this skin bag. That we are intimately intertwined with the world, and it's not just that the world affects us and conditions who we are and causes us, but we affect the world as well. And it's very hard, it's at least interesting when someone has died or a pet has died, just the strong memory that they have left with you. I mean, they are still acting on you in some sense. And I've come to appreciate that more and more. Yeah, Wade.
This is somewhat the case with my grandmother, who just passed, whose name you just can't. Who was 98 and had been suffering from dementia for quite some time. But it had gotten much worse in the past few years. And, you know, at the end, she's not a person anymore, right? When you can't see, can't respond to stimuli around you. And it made me wonder, at what point do you die? Because she wasn't herself. Right? She wasn't really anyone. But at one point she was. And so where in there did she die? Because it was not when her body stopped functioning. And I think that ties in to this way in which we all create each other. And the way in which people's or loved ones, pets, memories live on in us, and our effects continue to ripple out from us in time and space. And so, I don't know if I could tie that into, I don't know if I want to dive into reincarnation necessarily, but that's one way, I suppose, that you live on after you die.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, do you ever really? Right, or do the effects from you just kind of ripple out into the people around you and the effects that you have going forward, right? And that's you as much as any biological process. Or it's no more you than any biological process, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
Right? It's all part of the mix of everyone creating each other. and everyone, all things.
Yeah.
Creating each other in that moment.
Yeah, it's easier to see those kinds of things if you think we're not some sort of defined, fixed nugget in here. Right? So it isn't, you can't really say, well, when did she die? When was she no longer? It's really, when have I decided not to label her? When have I decided that she's not? I'm not going to call her my grandmother anymore. The strange thing as well, in addition for me, is that in Nagarjuna, there are arguments about how time doesn't exist, or not in the way we normally think about it, you know? I mean, because we think that each moment is separate from the previous moment, right? Or they would exist in the same moment, and they would be the same moment. There wouldn't be any time, because nothing would have changed. It wouldn't be one moment and then the following moment. And there can't really be a separation, on the other hand, because if they did, then this very instant would have been separated from whatever existed before, and it sprang out of absolutely nothing then, and there were nothing to cause it to arise. So there's some sort of continuity, but we don't know what it is. And, you know, I think Dogen will also talk about the continuity of time and how past, present, and future in some way might perhaps coexist now. So the question is your perception of them. I mean, as what happened when somebody dies is that, in a way, you've turned a corner and they didn't. So they're still there in some sense, but you can't see them. Those kinds of things are fun to think about, but I'm not sure they do a whole lot for your life. But at any rate, they're fun to think about. Yeah.
Maybe this whole conversation has made me think of Suzuki Roshi talking about the one hand that claps. And that one hand clapping still makes a sound, and that took me still something I'm wrapping my head around, the idea of how does it make a sound? But sound has to exist in order for it to make a sound. So like this, it's not a linear progression. It's not, you know, two hands clapping, you have an action and then you have a sound. But sound exists regardless. So one hand can clap and still make a sound, regardless of whether you hear it or not. And he was also talking about the idea of if you can see something, then it can vanish. But if you can't see something, i.e. if you don't label it, as you're talking about, if you don't have an attachment to it, then it exists always. It's really beautiful. So, maybe.
Suzanne.
So, back when we were talking about when is somebody dying, and something that you were saying that we can't quite remember, made me think about, I met two friends during a and both of them ended up dying like about a month apart from each other. And one was in complete denial and kept trying to keep kind of going in a direction. The other one really had this incredible grounding in where she was. And she was becoming, I'm going to get it all wrong, it's in the Christian faith, and I don't understand. But I think she was becoming ordained as deacon, is that something you get ordained as? Okay. And she's female deacon in her church, is a big controversy. Anyway, that bishop who came to the hospital, this was all happening in the hospital, because it was supposed to happen on a particular day, and she ended up in the hospital. There were a whole community of friends from all different areas of her life. And she's being, so she's a woman, and she's also a lesbian, she's being ordained as a school. So there are all these different elements of people gathered in the hospital in support of her and her partner. And it was this amazing connection and community that was happening. And the bishop came and could not like cross the threshold, I think, out of his own fear of death. And he ended up saying that he wasn't going to ordain her because she was dying and therefore would not have a, what's the following called, a community of following, whatever.
Congregation.
Yeah, congregation. So she's dying, so therefore she wanted a congregation, so we should ordain her. And we were all just looking around like, if this is not a congregation, and this is not, you know, a spiritual moment, then I don't know what it is, because the connections we have going through this in this very grounded, difficult, but real way was like the definition of connection and congregation. So, that question of like, when does a person die, you know, like, so they ignore this momentous thing happening at that threshold because it wasn't going to somehow be carried forward. Maybe you really think of that. Now it's that way. In that moment, what richness and connection is happening. The earth says, stars fall, thunder rolls, you know, like, it's like that.
Right.
The star falling, you know, it's the star dying, is it there, it's gone.
Yeah, a flash in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, a matter of perspective, is the star really falling? Like, where are you? So, where is the bishop? Where is the other what's impacting you? And you're talking about fear.
Thanks. Okay, so you had something you wanted to add.
Yes. So, you ordained her.
What?
You ordained her.
Right, and she ordained us. I mean, it was like this, it was, and I think they ended up sending somebody else who went through the ceremony. I think there was a ceremony. But I remember that moment of like, in this camp, and also the hesitation that he had.
Well, and I think that's what Douglas is talking about, like this presence that Master Ma was encouraging. But I was thinking, your cat was, and you were doing this together. You were Sun Face Buddha, and your cat is Moon Face Buddha. So it's all working together.
Yeah.
So I have a question that's personal for you.
Yes.
You know, a lot of the stuff that we're still hashing out takes place over 1,000 years ago. But I think if you were Bangla and you were approached by assistant Dharma teacher, Asian, how would you respond?
I think that's about the best I could do. I admire Master Ma for his strength. But we all have to express Buddha in our way. Are there any other... I guess we should probably wrap this up. Yes, Jan.
My sister died about 3 months ago. And she had a contacted me and told me that she had terminal lung cancer. So I went there. She was dying in Salt Lake City. So I went out to Salt Lake City to visit her. And I wanted to be with her before she actually died. I did not go back after she died. But I wanted to be with her while she was still alive. And it was interesting to see her. I think I was with her about 2.5 weeks before she died. And I was there for 4 days. And she would always remind me to wash my hands. And she, when it was time for me to go to the airport, one of her grandchildren, who she knew was not dependable, had promised to take me to the airport. And of course, she didn't show up right, or she was all confused. And from her pit, my sister arranged for me to get to the airport in time for my flight. And I look upon those things and I think that, you know, she couldn't eat a full meal. She couldn't get up for more than half an hour. She had to constantly be given oxygen. And also she was taking a very small morphine dose because of to control coughing. And it still fascinates me how that personality did not change when she was very, very ill. And her first husband, who was a great hunter, just before he died, he was dying of Hodgkin's disease. And it was less than 24 hours before he died, and they had taken him to the hospital, and he was in great misery. And the nurse came up to him, and she said, "I'm just so sorry we had to draw blood." And he said, "Did you bring your red pencil?"
Yeah.
I was my great neighbor. I mean, he was absolutely, he would have been world famous if he could have been world famous. But you know, that was his personality that did not change. And I think the same thing about Jesus on the cross. His personality did not change when he was in great misery. It's very interesting.
Thank you. I guess we should wrap this up, and why don't we chant the four Bodhisattva vows three times, and then we can have announcements. Beings are numberless.